is our last major event of the year for the Institute, and normally we have a situation in the past that's been where the President got up and pontificated about their view of the issues of the world over the last year. We're thankfully getting right away from that this year, and we've decided to have a special address by our guest today, Mr. John Fay. Now, no doubt most of you will, if you don't know him personally, will have heard John Fain. You've probably seen him on television as well as hearing him over the radio. Since I came to Victoria some years ago, I've listened to John Fain, I was about to say religiously, but I don't think I should use that word, with great appreciation and quite a lot of outrage from time to time. He is a remarkable interviewer and has built up a remarkable reputation for his show in the morning. And it's one of the absolute stars in the crown of the ABC. But he's not going to talk to us today about that. He's going to talk to us about something else that he's done. And I'm very envious of this, as a matter of fact. John and Jack took off, I think, last year? This year? Last year?
Took off the year before.
The year before. For 6 months, drove across the world in a trusty, I believe it was trusty, four-wheel drive.
A Toyota.
And we had a running commentary from time to time as John and Jack fed information back to the ABC just to prove that they were still alive and still travelling. And I found most of it fascinating. I think it would be a wonderful thing to do with your son, to do something like this for 6 months. Really special time. And John's, and I think Jack has contributed to the writing of the book. And we're going to hear about that today, which I think was absolutely marvellous. And in just one moment, John is going to come and talk to us. He said to me he's very happy to answer questions. And this is a dangerous thing to do, John. If they want to interrupt you as you go through, you say, that's quite all right. I worry a bit about that. It's a bit like Ricky Dix. But before I introduce him, I also want to congratulate Gary Morgan, who's sitting down here, because Gary, for the first time that I can recall for a very long time, got it absolutely right.
That's not right.
To the percentage point, the day before the election. So well done.
Thanks.
It's nice to be back here at Morgan's. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please join me in welcoming John Fay.
Thank you, Michael, and distinguished guests, and those of you who aren't distinguished, thank you very much. It's always interesting to hear from retired politicians who are only too happy to try to settle scores, but I don't think I ever had the opportunity to interview you, Michael, that I can remember.
No.
And it's always, to me, intriguing, and I delight in reading out text messages and taking calls from people who sometimes with consecutive text messages will accuse me of both being too hard and too soft on the person I've just interviewed or having given them a dream run because I prefer their side as opposed to the next texter who will say, you've just completely ruined your relationship with that entire political party and I'll never talk to you again and so on. I'm happy to talk about those things, although that's not why I was invited here, and I should stick to topic, something I seem to insist on from my guests. The book, I think Mark Ribot's got a stand outside and he's able to flog you a copy of the book from here to there, which came from the journey that Jack and I did when I had to get the bee out of my bonnet that started, really, the itch that I scratched started when I was a backpacker. I'll quickly also say that for those of you who don't like fine print, the audio book is now available, and I'm extra proud of that because Jack and I have read our own parts into the audiobook. So that's, I think, particularly appropriate for a road trip that people can sit in the car and listen to the journey. When I was a backpacker, though, and I took a year off, I did art tour at Monash University, and I hated it. First year uni was the unhappiest year of my life. And I have two older sisters, and one of them had dropped out of uni without finishing an arts degree at Melbourne Uni, and my parents were convinced that if I took a year off, I'd never finish, just like my eldest sister had not finished. So they were determined that I keep going, even though I desperately wanted a year off. And I needed that year off, and eventually I took it. And while I worked as a storeman for 8 months and then saved my money. And in fact, I thought being a storeman was pretty good. I quite liked running K rental cars, stationery and uniform stores. But when Ernie Pettorino took me across to the Waterside Hotel for lunch with a spag bol and a pot of beer one day and told me the stores were running really well and I had a future in stores, my whole life flashed before my eyes. And I did two things the next day. I re-enrolled at university and I bought a round-the-world ticket. Resigned from being storeman at K Rent-A-Car and went off around the world. While I was in London sleeping on someone's floor, someone who is now a very high-ranked executive at Telstra, I might say. It's quite funny the way people end up. She was then just a student, I might say, Dina Schiff, at the London School of Economics. But while I was sleeping on Dina's floor and then walking down the street one day, I was gobsmacked to see that in amongst all the decrepit, rusty Vauxhalls and Morrises, there was an old Land Rover with Australian number plates and that oval plaque, AUS, on the back. And it was covered in dents and bruises and jerry cans on the roof rack. And someone had driven that car from Australia to London. And I just stood there spellbound staring at it, and I swore to myself right then and there, and this would have been 77, I am going to do that one day. So Jan and I always thought, well, when I retire or the ABC come to their senses and show me the door, that'll be the trip. And some years ago, and we always had that on the back burner, you know, one day, one day, one day. And some years ago, Jan said, look, I know you keep talking about it, and I know I've said all along I'll come with you, but no, I'm not coming. And we were on a family holiday one Christmas, and we were actually in a car driving from Amman to Damascus, and we were crossing the border between Jordan and Syria. And it's a very large no man's land, and there's a big concrete area, and you park your car and you get out and you have to go and queue up and get your passport checked. And as soon as you say you're a journalist, of course, it takes forever. And while we were waiting around for someone who we couldn't even see to put the stamp in the passport, Jan turned around from the front seat of the Chevrolet and said to Jack, this is what it would have been like on the big drive. Why don't you do it with your dad in your gap year? And I had been offered and negotiated for long service leave with the ABC. And so I had this opportunity, which I was going to use for other things, but suddenly the coincidence of my long service leave and Jack's gap year created this irresistible opportunity. Jack thought about it for about 24 hours, and then he came back to me and said, yeah, I'll do it, but with one condition. And I said, with great trepidation of all the things that he could put in as a condition, what might it be? He said, I'm in charge of music. There's a United Nations Convention Against Torture, and I'm sure you're all familiar with it. But I decided it was worth the risk, so I readily agreed, thinking, well, what a fabulous opportunity. That's a small price to pay. And, in fact, as we tell in the book, he ended up listening to more of my music, the sort of James Taylor and Bob Dylan stuff, than I ended up listening to his. But we just had the most fabulous opportunity to do something together that... look, I could rattle off, and as I've been told, it's bad form to name drop. Mick Jagger told me that. From Peter Costello to John Brumby, even just a few weeks ago, I've had so many people in public life say how they wish they could get time out, and in our hectic schedules, most of us never do it. And I took an enormous professional risk in my industry, more so than whatever industries you all come from, whether you're from business and commerce or whether you're from the public sector, it doesn't matter. But there's nothing as unforgiving as the media, I assure you. And the standard rule, as Red Simons reminds us regularly on The Breakfast Show, is that never take a holiday, and if you do, make sure the person who replaces you is shit. And I failed on both fronts. First of all, I took a long holiday, and the person who replaced me was Ali Moore, and she's terrific. So I took a huge risk, but I don't regret it for a moment. And if it meant when I came back they'd said, look, with hindsight, you're not that flash, I was quite ready for that. I was quite happy to take that as the price of this experiment. But we set out. We took on... I basically spent 9 months almost full-time preparing. So I'd go to work. I leave home at 5.15, 5.20 in the morning. I get up at 4.43. And it's because the alarm clock's stuck, you see. So if I move it, the hand breaks, so it just stays there. And I get to work by about 5:30, and by the time I finish, I try and leave the office by 2-ish, 2:30, and I would typically, for 6 to 8 months, I just went home and started all over again, and sometimes I'd go to bed after midnight and then get up after only a few hours sleep and do another show. I tell you that against my own interest because, of course, you all think that I'm phenomenally prepared for what I'm doing in the morning, and I try to be as best I can, but to get this thing together, I didn't have anyone to whom I could delegate any of the planning, and absolutely everything had to be done by me. So from getting maps and visas and passports and permission to drive through China, which all the guidebooks tell you is not allowed, getting the car, finding the car, choosing what sort of car, defying the so-called experts about which was the best type of car, kitting it out, testing it, Jack had only just got his, he was just finishing school, getting his license, making sure he actually got it, sending him on an advanced driver's course, we both did a first aid course, and on it went. The amount of preparation, I can't begin to tell you how complicated it was, and there's a good part of the book devoted to some of those sorts of stories and logistics, because that's what the journey became. In a way, it became an incredible, and I call it this, an indulgent conceit. Yes, it's great. You set out from your front gate and you drive to Trafalgar Square. And along the way, and almost all of it, I might say, the only ship we took was from Darwin to Dili and then car ferries through the Indonesian islands. So we drove to Darwin. The ship we were supposed to go on was in dry dock in Singapore, we found out in Woomera. When we got to Woomera, we did 1,000 k's on the first day from Melbourne to Port Augusta. We were planning on doing 1,000 k's a day for 4 days to get to Darwin in time to catch the ship. And on day two, when we pulled into Woomera at 9 in the morning, we'd left Port Augusta at 6, having driven 1,000 k's the day before. We rang Darwin to say, yes, we're on time, see you Thursday. And they went, oh, your ship's in Singapore in dry dock. So that was, from day two, that was the sort of thing that happens all the time. But when we eventually got to Dili, we drove through and we went to Kupang and then from on a car ferry, just your local Indonesian car ferry, the sort you promised your mother you'd never go on. We went from there to Flores, through Flores to Sumbawa, through Sumbawa to Lombok, through Lombok to Bali, to Java, to Sumatra, with a ferry to Singapore. And then Singapore, it's by road, all the way to Turkey. Singapore across the causeway, Malaysia, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, into China, all the way across China, and a 5,000 kilometre detour because of the Chinese authorities telling us we weren't allowed to go where we wanted to, and I can talk about that some more. Up to Mongolia, through Mongolia and the Gobi Desert in a snowstorm to the western Altai Mountains, across through a pass you're not allowed to go through if you're anything other than either Mongolian or Chinese, it's closed to foreigners, the mosquito-infested trading post of Tashkent, where the car was impounded because the document we had authorising the car to come back into China was the printout of an attachment to an email, which was not acceptable to the border police. They wanted to see the original to make sure it wasn't forged. A man had to get into a taxi in Urumqi, 600 kilometres away, and bring an original document to the border, a piece of paper. I looked at it and said, OK, now you can go. So we spent 3 days staying in Tashkent, the only foreigners in the entire town, and staying in the only place you can stay, which was the brothel. Jack didn't seem to mind, but I was just a little bit concerned. Very friendly, I can assure you. And then we drove back through Xinjiang, the Muslim part of Western China, where there's trouble with the Uyghurs now, and we were just at that time when it was starting to brew. We saw some fights and various things, but from Urumqi down to Kola, Kaku, and then eventually to Kashgar, over the Torogut Pass, and through a snowstorm into Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, or as I call it, Turkmadmenistan. Makes North Korea look sensible and sane. Through Iran, from the east to the west, right across Iran, along the border with Azerbaijan and Armenia, which is a highly militarised road where, again, you're not allowed to go. Into Turkey, right across Turkey, across the... we didn't go to Istanbul, we crossed at Gallipoli, down the Gallipoli Peninsula, just fabulous, into Greece, the ferry from Igoumenitsas across to Italy, up the Italian peninsula, through the mountains, Mont Blanc Tunnel into Switzerland, France, and hey, you're on freeways already, aren't you? So the adventure was over. So that's the overview. I'm quite happy to zero in on any aspects of it, and I do invite you, if you've got a particular question, or whether it's about logistics or security, I mean, people endlessly say, oh, but weren't you afraid? And at no stage were we, I think, under any genuine threat except from bad drivers. And that was a daily occurrence. But the world simply is not full of people who are trying to kill you. It just isn't. And wherever we went, we were made unbelievably welcome. And people were extraordinarily curious and friendly. And never confuse governments with people. I mean, I hardly need to say that to this audience, surely. And wherever we went, people would cheerfully embrace us, sometimes welcome us to their homes, wanting to know as much about us as we wanted to know about them. And the great regret is that we only had 6 months. I couldn't get any more time as it was. That was really pushing it. And we had to constantly be on the go. I was facing divorce if I didn't get to Paris in time for Christmas with Jan and some other friends who'd promised to meet us. And I was so determined. And what we had to do sometimes to maintain progress was quite extraordinary. And special fees, marvellous things, special fees, a bit of cash, US dollars, does a wonderful thing at the border crossing. Speeds you up, gets you through a queue, all sorts of problems can be resolved. And at no stage did I really ever think we weren't going to make it, although there were a few moments where I thought, this could go pear-shaped right here and now. But everything can be dealt with, everything can be sorted. Some of the other truisms, I suppose, would be that everywhere we went, even though we were made welcome, people would say to us, here you are safe, but when you go to the next island, town, valley, ethnic group, country, they will slit your throat and steal everything you own. But here you're safe. And when you get to the next town, island, valley, province, they say, ah, those people back there, they are bad people. You're lucky you got out with everything you've got, and you're lucky you didn't get your throat cut, but here you're safe. And on it went. Everywhere where we went, people were extraordinarily suspicious, if not downright hostile to their own neighbours, and astonished that we had just basically gone for a drive. And when you think about it, that's all we did. And the people in China drive to Mongolia, the people in Uzbekistan drive to Kyrgyzstan, and all we did was really string it all together. And yet, nobody knows much about what's around the corner, but they're absolutely sure it's terrible. And I found that really sad. I found that very disheartening, time and time again. Muslims are suspicious of Christians, who are suspicious of Hindus, who are suspicious of... I mean, no one even thinks about Jews. To tell them we were Jewish was just unbelievable. In fact, I'm a lapsed Jew. I'm about as bad a Jew as you can get. So to say you didn't believe in God was even more challenging, or to them, unbelievable. And I learned very quickly, in fact, especially with Muslims, you don't say you don't believe in God. Because if you say you don't believe in God, you're saying you don't believe in their God, which challenges their very fundamentals. And so instead you just fudge it. And if people asked, you know, what do you believe in? You'd say, well, Australia is a Christian country mostly. But there's lots of other people and everyone lives pretty much happily together. And that was a satisfactory answer without in any way threatening where people were coming from. But again and again, you found people, you know, the ground is soaked in blood in so many places. We went through Andijan where there's been a massacre on the Kyrgyz-Uzbek border. And just even since we've been back, there's been terrible tension, if not violence, on the border there. There were thousands of people fleeing from Uzbekistan, and then Kyrgyzstan had a revolution, and then they were fleeing back across the border the other way. The Burma-Laos border, which we drove along in those mountains, likewise. So many places, the ground is soaked in blood, and yet the people, wherever you go, they're wonderful, and they're just being buffeted around by the wings of history in a way that it's heartbreaking time and time again. We also experienced some wonderful things. We were killing time to get permission into China. You have to, if you seek official approval to drive a car, a foreign registered car, into China, you're told it's not possible. And this took about 4 months of negotiation to get permission to drive through China. And when we originally tried to do it, we were just told, no, that's simply not allowed. And then I found, staying up, surfing the internet and trying to find ways of getting a foreign registered car through China, I thought of the Beijing to Paris vintage cars that did the recreation. So I got in touch with Warren Brown. And he said, oh, we arranged that through the embassy. So I got in touch with someone at the Australian Embassy in Beijing, and they wrote back and said, we are not a travel agent. And I got in touch with Wendy Wu Tours, who claimed to specialise in China, and they said, what you want is not possible. So then I checked Footprints, Garden, Lonely Planet, and they said it's not possible for a foreigner to drive a car or hire a car or get a licence to drive in China. And on it went. And then I stumbled on a press release from Volkswagen when they launched their Touareg four-wheel drive, the great V10 diesel monster. They drove it with journalists from Berlin to Beijing to show how tough it was. And at the bottom of the press release, and I was thinking, well, how did they get permission? It had a little thank you to Nuovo Tours China. So I tracked down Nuovo Tours China and sent them an email and said, can you help us? I want to drive from Melbourne to London, and that will be through China. I don't want to go by ship to India or any of those sorts of things. And they wrote back and said, look, we specialise in taking European groups from the Berlin Wall to the Great Wall of China, was their gag. But we take groups from Europe, commercial tours in large groups. So if that's what you want, we can help you. And I wrote back and said, well, I'm not coming from Europe. We're not a commercial group. We're not a commercial organisation. We're not a group. It's a father and son. We're coming from Australia, and we want to drive across the Silk Road. And so they wrote back, and this, I swear there would be 100 emails getting to the point where they said, no, unless it's a group, we can't help you. We could do something from the Laos border. We could do something with you, but you need to have more than one car, because we only do groups. That's the visa category that this falls into. And so I said, well, we've got more than one car. And although they said, why don't you find another family who want to do the drive and join up with them? And I went, well, that's, you know, degree of difficulty, 99 out of 100, sorry. I said, but we've got another car. How about if we say we've got two cars, we book for two cars, we get the visa for two cars, but then on the day when we arrive at the border, only one car turns up. Maybe the other one had a smash. And Tracy wrote back and said, yeah, that'll be all right. As long as you're booking for two cars, paying for two cars, you get a visa for two cars. If one of them has a smash, no one can do anything about that. We'll meet you at the border. It cost a fortune, I should say. But that is how Chinese bureaucracy works. And on that basis, we got permits to drive through China. And they'd never done a trip from Laos, south north, and they'd never done a one-car trip before and so on. Now I might say it's all different. And I've had maybe, I don't know, 10 different people contact me since we did our drive, and they've all managed to get permission. They've people who have driven mostly from Europe coming this way, a few who have gone the other way, including one man from Melbourne, David Gaines, with his son. They've just last week arrived in London, having done as much of the same trip as we did as possible. But already, in just the 18 months since we finished, it's not possible to do what we did. There's been a revolution in Kyrgyzstan, and so they had to go up through Russia and then down through the Ukraine. And Iran, of course, has also had all sorts of internal and domestic problems that have made life difficult there as well. But the story in the book, Jack writes his bits and I write my bits, and we try and tell it. It's not a travel book in the sense of a guide to, you know, we go to Angkor Wat, but we don't tell you the history of Angkor Wat. You can find that out anywhere. You know, there's hundreds of books written about Angkor Wat, so we don't dwell on it. We don't do it day by day. What we've picked out are either funny or bad things or awkward things, or things that illustrate the complexities of the journey that we undertook. And there's a fair bit of information about what I call the catch-22 of interlocking, the jigsaw puzzle of interlocking visas. For instance, when you want to go through Iran and Turkmenistan, to go through Turkmenistan to Iran, you can only get a transit visa for Turkmenistan once you've got the visa for the next country you're going to, which is Iran. So you're in Uzbekistan in Tashkent, you're trying to get a visa to go through Turkmenistan, they won't give it to you until you've got the Iranian visa. The Iranians won't give you a visa until they know how you're getting into their country. You've got to say what day and what place you're entering. Well, the Turkmenistanis won't approve you going at a particular crossing on a particular day until you've got your Iranian visa. So each is waiting for the other, and you go backwards and forwards, and you find yourself in Tashkent day after day after day, standing in a queue outside the embassy gate rather than enjoying all that Tashkent has to offer. Frustrations like that are enough to, you know, test your mettle, but that's just what's involved. But we had a fabulous series of adventures, the food, the people we ate. There's a list in here of the things we ate, most exotic foods imaginable, in particular in China, where once you get away from tourist China and you get to backblocks China, the experience is just fabulous. And we met people who asked if they could have their children pose for photos with us because they'd never seen Europeans before. we were eating in a woman's house one day and I'm using my chopsticks. I think I'm pretty good, but she's laughing at me. And then she says to our guide, who has to sit in the car with you every day and go everywhere with you to keep an eye on you to make sure you're not a spy, she says to our guide, the old man, and gee, that hurt, he's not very good with chopsticks, so what does he use to eat? And so she had no concept of knives and forks. She'd never seen or heard of knives and forks. But she had seen Europeans once on a bus. They'd gone past. But she asked if her children could come out to stare at us because they'd never seen Westerners before. And on those experiences went. We ate in Mongolia. I'm sure there are people here who have been to Mongolia, but we drove across Mongolia through the Gobi Desert in a snowstorm, and the Gobi Desert is absolutely flat, like any desert, as far as the eye can see. But in a snowstorm, you don't know where the road is anymore, and we're the only car to the horizon in every direction, and you have no bearings. There's no feature. As far as the eye can see is a flat, white plain without the slightest indentation in it showing you where the road is. So you're navigating with a compass and a map. And the only thing we found eventually was a row of telephone poles. No wires, just poles. And we thought, well, they have to go somewhere. We'll follow them. So you're bumping along at walking speed, going crashing through all the divots and the ruts, trying to find your way to a village. When you get there, you ask people where you are, and they don't understand you. And then you encounter the next Mongolian little nicety designed to trip you up, which is that each province has towns with the same name. So you arrive in Balgan and you say, is this Balgan? And they say, yes, but it's Balgan in Khovd Amag rather than Balgan in some other Amag. You're in the wrong place. And you bump into someone on the road and you ask them how you get to this town and they say that way, but in fact it's that way because there is another town by the same name there. It's like saying someone which way to High Street and there's 50 High Streets and you don't know which one you've been led to. But eventually, you know, you get your way through. You get your way through. And bizarre coincidences. We got to the town in Mongolia where we thought we were stuck. We couldn't find the mountain pass. It had been snowing for 3 days. We'd been told that if it keeps snowing, we'd never get across the mountains to get back into China. We'd be literally stuck. We didn't have visas for Russia, and you couldn't get them unless you sent your passport back to Canberra. We couldn't go back to China because we didn't have multiple China entries for that part of China, only for Xinjiang. We couldn't go anywhere. If we were stuck, we were stuck. The car would have been basically left in Mongolia, and we would have had to fly home. And we pull into a hotel. It's the only place in this little town to stay. No one speaks a word of English. We think, well, what we'll do is the next morning is my plan to go to the police station and see if there's anyone there who can direct us to someone who speaks English, who can direct us to someone who can guide us to get across the mountain pass that we couldn't find. And, in fact, what happens is Jack goes downstairs. He's left something in the car. He goes down to the car after we've gone to bed, locks the car, comes back inside and hears people speaking English in the foyer of the hotel. Once a month, there's an American Peace Corps volunteer who conducts English classes in this town. It's that night in that hotel. Jack comes upstairs and says, they're speaking English downstairs. We both put on clothes, run downstairs, and find one of the students in the class is prepared to take a few days off work and guide us through the mountains. For what for them was the extraordinary sum that we negotiated, and I was happy to pay of $100 US, which to them was about a month's pay. To me, it was a get-out-of-jail card. So I might say with the $100 came a massive Kazakh-embroidered bed cover, which was part of the deal from his mother's dowry, I'm told, although that's probably bullshit, but it was a pretty good line. And it's a beautiful piece of hand-embroidered work anyway, and an experience that was absolutely priceless. So there's all sorts of coincidences and all sorts of stories. And it was the adventure of a lifetime. And as I say in the book, I'd recommend it to anyone, but I'd never do it again. But you could turn that around and say, I wish I could do it again, but I certainly wouldn't do it that way. What's the point in going to some of the most exotic places on earth, but barely having time to look around because you just go, 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 moving on because you're on a deadline? To have a year or even 2 years to do it would be fantastic. And there are people out there doing the most wonderful trips. I got an email yesterday from Chris and Elaine Clash. In a car they have made themselves, or Chris has made, and they're from Ferntree Gully. He's a fairly well-to-do entrepreneur and businessman, sold up everything, built a car, so it looks like a dune buggy, and they're driving around the world. They've been on the road for 2 years, and they've just finished South America. And there are people out there doing the most extraordinary things. Jack and I were in Iran climbing a mountain pass, big zigzag sort of road, up, 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 thinking, wow, you've got the whole world laid out below us here. Look at this, it's extraordinary. I'll bet you hardly anyone comes here. Turn around the next corner, there's two Frenchmen on bicycles. And we're in Turkmenistan. We're driving through the desert near Merv, the ancient biblical city, and the ruins of which are sadly in massive disrepair. Jack says to me, I reckon we'd be the only Australians in Turkmenistan. And me being the perennial smartass, I say, well, we're probably the only father and son Australians driving across from Melbourne to London in a white Toyota in Turkmenistan. But let's see. We get into Ashgabat. There's not a room to be got in any of the hotels. There's a big mining and petroleum conference on. Turkmenistan's this maddest country on earth. You know, this is where gas is cheaper than matches, so you light the stove and leave it on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There are gilded statues to the dictator. Gary, you'd love this. It's a great idea. Gilded statues, 20-foot-high statue of the dictator in gold on a plinth, 4 stories high in the main square, and it rotates to always face the sun as the sun goes through the sky every day. And so on. The cult of personality, it is unbelievable. We eventually find we can get a room and a homestay in Ashgabat. I'm sick, I've got some sort of tummy bug. I go to bed early. Jack goes out on the town and meets some KGB and local kids in a story he tells in the book. Has a wild time, refuses the prostitutes, smokes the dope, but has a great time. And then the next morning I get up to have a pee and I go out across the courtyard, past the tethered goat, into the loo, and then come out, shut the door, and sneaking back, hoping not to wake everyone, and there's a kid in a tracksuit standing leaning on our car with his arm over the bull bar, and he says, g'day, where are you from? And staying in the same homestay is a young Australian doctor and his physio girlfriend who have been in Beijing for the Olympics, because that's where we are. We're just after the Beijing Olympics. And they've come overland from Beijing, and we have breakfast with Lockie and Helene, and I reckon it's at least an hour after we start talking that we discover he wasn't at the Olympics as a spectator, he was there as a competitor. He was in the Australian Olympic team, and after the Olympics he and his girlfriend set off to go overland from Beijing by public transport to Europe. And we'd bumped into them in the same homestay in Ashgabat. So the book's full of funny stories and bizarre things that happen on the road. Look, I'm happy to answer questions. You've all been very, very kind indulging me yet again. And I'm happy to answer questions about the ABC just as much as about the trip that we did. Because I know people are endlessly fascinated in how it all works and what it all means. So thank you very, very much for listening to me so politely. And thank you for your time.
I might supervise the question asking. John, before he started, he said, I can speak for as long as you like, and I believe it was absolutely terrific. Burnett.
A very simple question, double barrel, if I may. First of all, where did you carry your stash of US dollars? Literally.
Yep.
And secondly, did you not have a GPS with you?
No.
And what was the reason?
I guess I got sick of gadgets, to answer your second question first. We had laptops with internet connections from those little USB dongles, and we ran a blog, which I regret and loved. It was a lovely thing to do, but it just drove us mad. People come to expect, like if we didn't post something for 3 or 4 days, they'd start bombarding us with emails saying, why aren't you putting anything up? And you become a slave to it, and it became a bit of a nuisance, but there you go. We had cameras, still and film, satellite phone, mobile phones, laptops, and the gadgetry was just getting, you know, we had a whole tub of chargers and adapters and plugs and leads, and I was thinking, oh, this is just becoming a pain. And then when we thought of GPS, I thought, well, where are we really going to use it? And with hindsight, it would have been really good in Milan. But getting lost in Milan or Jakarta or Bangkok, I mean, that's part of the fun. No good in the Gobi Desert, absolutely pointless. And in Jakarta, it's gridlocked, so you've got lots of time to work out where you're lost. In Bangkok, we hired a taxi driver, and we said to him, go slow and take us out of the town, because we got lost and got stuck. And we just followed him. We gave him $10, and he guided us through the labyrinth that is Bangkok's freeways. And so on. We did that a couple of times. People were very, very helpful. You stop, you ask directions, you meet people, they invite you home, and so on it goes. I was very happy not to have a GPS, and I'm quite happy with maps and a compass. The stash we had, because I'm such a worrywart, we had several stashes of $1,000, each in small denominations, rolled up very tight. One was in an Ovaltine can. So we had a tub. We had a tub of car parts, a tub of food and cooking, a tub of equipment and guidebooks, and then we had bags of hot weather clothes and cold weather clothes each, and that was the back of the car. And in the food tub, there was a little spirit stove, which we used precisely three times in 6 months, twice in Mongolia and once in Turkey. But in there was a little tin of Milo or Ovaltine or something, and if you picked it up, it looked like a can of you know, something you put in your drink. But in fact, inside was $1,000 in small notes. There was another one. We had those antiseptic wipes, baby wipes, which we used a lot, which I recommend. And there was several of those in a tub, and one of them was a dummy. And inside the wipes was $1,000. They smelled beautiful, those notes, by the time. And there was another one inside the camera case. So, you know, in your camera bag, you've got webbing and you've got foam. And so between some of the foam and the bag, laid flat, was the last stash of $1,000. And even though we were searched incredibly thoroughly three or four times, no one found any of them. The most thorough search was in Turkey, where they literally nearly took the car apart, which is in the eastern part of Turkey where the Kurdish independence movement is active. But they didn't. In Timor, they started pulling sterile bandages out of packets. But, you know, no one ever found our stash of money each time. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, John, I read your bit in the RACV, and I'm interested in having an 18-year-old son myself. How the relationship with your son would have gone. I presume, as you described in there, there were ups and downs, but eating the foods, all that sort of stuff, was it an emotional nightmare?
No, it was an adventure. There were only a few occasions of actual conflict, which is an astonishing testament to Jack's capacity to put up with me rather than the other way around. I can't speak highly enough of my son, and I'll get all emotional talking about it, but it's quite an incredible thing. And halfway through, I don't remember where, some remote jungle in Laos or somewhere, he turned to me, and we're just driving along, slowly making our way through, and he said, you know, none of my friends could do this with their dad. And I thought, well, he's kind of putting it on me, but what he's really saying is, I'm pretty good, hey? You know, I'm putting up with you for 6 months. But on the other hand, he was quite open about this, and he writes about it. He got to go to places in the world he never will ever get to any other way, and he got to do it in a way, like with a car, as an independent traveller, where you're not dependent on transport, you're not dependent on other people's schedules and timetables or access. If you're driving down a road and you see something interesting, you just go and have a look at it. And if you want to go that way instead of that way, everywhere except those countries like China and Iran where they try and govern where you go, you just do it yourself. And that was fabulous. And we started off, you know, even though I work shift work, it was always a feature of my working life all through his schooling. Even though I start at 5:30, it meant I finished in time to do the school pickup. So I'd been involved as a dad in things like after school sport and things like that. And I think that was all really good. I learned ages ago that when kids are telling you they can't bear you, that means they want more of you, not the other way around. And you have to work through that with you, especially with teenagers. Rather than take them literally at face value, it's usually the exact opposite. And his brother, I mean, you know, his older brother, who's my stepson, Nigel, but he's been with me since he was very young. If Nigel had come with us, it would have been him or me out of the car by Malmesbury. I mean, I'm not putting myself on a pedestal, but that relationship, he was a schoolboy when we left, and for the first 6 weeks, all he talked about was every umpire that wrongly had given him out in cricket, and, you know, who the kids at muck-up day who were that were getting into trouble, and who got what in their VCE results. His whole mindset was school, and then gradually that all dropped off, and in front of my eyes I saw this transformation, and it was an absolutely wonderful thing, an absolute privilege. And his photography, the photos in the book are 90% his. And he had been, you know, had shown no sign, no interest in taking photos until he was appointed official photographer. And then he got a couple of friends who were studying photography at uni to show him a few tricks, and then he became one of these kids, and it completely caught me by surprise, totally ambushed me. He could work out all those buttons on the back of the camera that none of us ever use, and he worked out Photoshop and how to manipulate a photo and how to turn it from a snapshot into a portrait and all of this stuff. It was just fabulous.
And to see that happen in front of my eyes was an absolute joy. Sorry, you were late.
Did you have forward bookings at all for hotels? Or what I really mean is, did you have to camp sometimes or sleep in the car? And if you did, were you frightened of being attacked if you did that? And just another little question is, the car was obviously a right-hand drive car. I'm aware a little bit myself, having driven in Europe. Was that a problem at times, going through some of those the difficult terrain, being dangerous?
Absolutely. We were wrong side of the road from the Malaysia-Cambodia border, where it changes. And I might say no man's land between Malaysia and Cambodia when you're in a car is fabulous, because it's neither left nor right-hand drive. But from there, from Cambodia through Cambodia, Laos, China, Mongolia, and all the stands, and all the way till we got off the ferry in England, we were on the wrong side of the road, almost the whole way. And yes, that poses certain challenges, but you have to have your wits about you whichever side of the road you're on. And when we nearly came a cropper, it was not because I was driving on the wrong side of the road. The steering wheel was on the wrong side. It was would have happened regardless. In fact, on one occasion it may even have saved us from a terrible prank, because I knew precisely how far into the ditch I could go, because I was in the ditch as the two Iranian B-double trucks overtaking on a U-bend coming towards us. Left no room on the road. I knew precisely how close to the mountainside I could go rather than having to guess. The complexities of the car, I could talk about that forever. If there are car enthusiasts here and four-wheel drivers, there's another whole book just for them that I haven't even written. We had no bookings from the day we left home until the apartment in Paris where we were staying. And we didn't take a tent. The reason for that is that in Asia, accommodation is extremely cheap and readily available. Once we got north of Asia into Mongolia, it was too cold to camp. Through Europe, it's either unsafe in the stands or too cold again. And so we decided it would be wasted space. And there was only one night where I thought we were going to sleep in the car when we couldn't find anywhere. And that was in Kyrgyzstan when we got lost. And in the end, at about 11 o'clock at night in a snowstorm, we knocked on someone's door and they pointed to us. And then when we didn't understand their directions, they got in our back seat and directed us about 2 km down the road to a guest house, which was shut for winter, but they knocked on the kitchen door and they opened it for us and accommodated us. We left in the beginning of July and we got to Paris for Christmas. So it was becoming winter.
I've been waiting to do this. I'm sorry, John. We're going to have a break for the news in a second.
That's lovely.
We've got some more questions, though. There was one out the back.
John, fantastic. I was a specific question as a retired engineer. I know you're a very skilled mechanic, having heard your program a lot. What about antibiotics? Ever since my first tooth died about 20 years ago, whenever I travelled overseas, particularly to places like Russia, I've made sure my dentist prescribes and I have some broad-spectrum antibiotics.
We had a whole tub of medicine, and we used some of it and didn't use a lot of it. We took lots of things we didn't use. And some of them, it's good you didn't use them. We didn't use the EPIRB, the Emergency Position Indicator Rescue Beacon. And I'm glad we didn't use that, because if we did, it would have meant we were in real strife. We took it sat in the centre console the whole trip, and then I brought it home and we sold it on eBay and I got my money back. I took binoculars. I never used them. Not once. I'm sorry. I just didn't. Okay. We took a big medical kit, hardly used any of it, which is great. But I had an emergency dental kit, which the dentist gave me. We had two first aid kits, a small one and a big one. Hardly used them. And we had antibiotics. We had adrenaline in case of allergic reaction. We had Solone tablets. You name it, we had it. And most of it came home again. Most of it's now expired its use-by date and gets thrown away, of course. We had things for tummies, we had things for heads, we had things for colds, we had things for skin, we had everything imaginable, on the basis that you couldn't rely on getting anything on the road. We had a tub of spare parts and tools for the car. I had a full toolkit, never used it. Had snatch straps for the four-wheel drive, used them to pull other people out of trouble, never used it for ourselves, and on it goes. We had spare fuel and oil filters, used all of them. Air filters, used two of them. Spare hoses and belts, didn't use any of them, and had to tighten up one bolt on a shock absorber once, two bolts on a front mudguard once, and one bolt on a back luggage rack once, and that's all. The biggest disaster in the car was the CD player jammed. And we were using a little MP3 player anyway, an iPod. But the car, I have no connection to Toyota whatsoever and no brief with them. I bought the car with my own money, second hand. It was 3 years old and it was unbelievable. I fully expected all sorts of things to happen. Nothing went wrong. It's absolutely astonishing. It was a Prado, a Toyota Prado, automatic. I insisted on ABS and I insisted on things like central locking and cruise control. And the car, Land Rovers are hopelessly unreliable and thirsty. And some people from the Land Rover Club got very angry with me, and they have a website. And they said, look at this clown, he thinks he's going to drive across the world in a Toyota Prado. What a deal. If he goes to Africa, he'll see there's Land Rovers everywhere, and you can fix them on the side of the road. And someone from the Toyota four-wheel drive club wrote and said, yeah, they fix them on the side of the road because they break down all the time, you idiot. And I must say, I have never owned a Toyota before, and I don't own one now. The car's been sold. But it was unbelievable how well that car performed.
It's called total quality management.
Well, it might be, but it was breathtaking.
I'm really sorry to have to do this.
Hope for the best, but plan for the worst.
That's right.
Yeah. I'm really sorry to have to do this because I know people. Some people have to get back to work at 2 o'clock. They don't start at 5:30 in the morning.
No, they don't.
But I'd like to invite Lawrence Wade, who's one of the councillors, to come up and move over. Most appreciative vote of thanks.
Thank you.
And you spoke the whole time without mentioning the veterans' hockey.
On behalf of the Australian Institute of International Affairs, Victorian Division, I'd very much like to acknowledge John Fanning's really terrific speech today. And I think it caps a really interesting year for the Institute. We've had any number of signature, significant, symbolic, sometimes quite saddening and perturbing presentations this year on matters global and topical. Sometimes we think after some of our presentations that the world is going to hell in a handbasket. So it's been a great year for the Institute, and I would like to, before formally thanking John, just also acknowledge the contribution made by so many people for the success of this organisation, both in the year just past and in the year ahead. I'd like to acknowledge Michael McKellar, recently re-elected by adulation or acclamation, President at our last AGM, to be our President for the coming year. His colleagues on the Executive Committee, Graham Barrett, Les Rowe and Gordon Trivett, our hard-working professional staff, Andrew Hilton and Peter McDermott, for all your superb work this year. Without you, we do, Peter McDermott. Yes, we couldn't begin to cope without the fabulous work that you do, so thank you very much for that. For the support from the Readings bookstore chain, who've been here today selling John's book and have done so for other authors we've had the chance to launch books for this year. To our national president, whom I see here today as well, Melissa Conlitano, for the great support you give us from the national office up in Canberra. And for all the magnificent speakers also who have given us their time and their intellect and their thoughts at the various events we've had over the last year. And also for the series that we have coming up next year, the Global Series, a remarkable series of events that we have arranged starting in February next year with the American ambassador speaking to us at the RACV Club in February. The date is...
5th, the 10th, the 7th,
can we compromise?
The 10th? Thursday the 10th,
February, the American ambassador speaking to us. On March the 7th, we have Bjorn Lomborg speaking to us, the noted climate change and, I'd say, economist. And we have a number of other quite remarkable events coming up next year, which we hope to see all of you and many more people as well. This year has been a very interesting one for the Institute. We are planning, I think, some quite... interesting patterns of growth for the organisation in coming years in terms of the scale and scope and reach of what we do, to bring awareness of foreign affairs matters to as broad an audience as possible, which is really our reason for being as an organisation. And so those events that I've just mentioned that we've had in the last year and coming out next year are really just designed to do that, is to act in a non-partisan sense, but to open up people's minds to as broad a range of topics as possible on matters foreign affairs. And after the events we've had this year on weighty topics, how delightful to finish this year with John. And to give us a very, I think, very shrewd and insightful perspective, freighted through the context of a really marvellous emotional journey, a technical journey, a logistical journey, an administrative journey, a geographical journey through many countries in which many of us have an interest, of course, in terms of foreign affairs, and done so through really a remarkably beautifully written book, too. I really do commend John on his capacities in a writing sense as well as a verbal sense in terms of what you've written here, and I highly recommend this book to anyone who hasn't read it. before. It makes a classic Christmas gift, I think, it's both topical, interesting.
Oh, and
so I stop now, John. And another thing the Institute has happening this year is a study tour to Vietnam that's been led by Les Rowe and Zara Kimpton. The study tour to Vietnam has sold out. We've exceeded the number of people we can take on it. I think study tours in the future will be a very, have always been and will continue to be a very popular source of both income for the Institute and activity for our members and guests who wish to come with us. And so, John, should you ever do a Kerry O'Brien and move on to other things, I think you'd be most welcome to come work with us as a study tour guide to some of the companies that you've been to or may wish to visit and take some of our members with you. I think you'd be fantastic in that regard as a study tour guide. Nice. So, thank you, John. So, on behalf of the Institute, John, thank you very much indeed for coming here today. And,